Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Post-American World by Fareed Zakaria. Read by the author.
Chapter 1. The Rise of the Rest. This is a book not about the decline of America, but rather about the rise of everyone else. It is about the great transformation taking place around the world, a transformation that, though often discussed, remains poorly understood. This is natural. Changes, even sea changes, take place gradually. Though we talk about a new era, the world seems one with which we are familiar. But in fact, it is very different. There have been three tectonic power shifts over the last 500 years. Fundamental changes in the distribution of power that have reshaped international life, its politics, economics, and culture. The first was the rise of the Western world, a process that began in the 15th century and accelerated dramatically in the late 18th century. It produced modernity as we know it, science and technology, commerce and capitalism, the agricultural and industrial revolutions. It also produced the prolonged political dominance of the nations of the West. The second shift, which took place in the closing years of the 19th century, was the rise of the United States. Soon after it industrialized, the United States became the most powerful nation since Imperial Rome, and the only one that was stronger than any likely combination of other nations. For most of the last century, the United States has dominated global economics, politics, science, and culture. For the last 20 years, that dominance has been unrivaled, a phenomenon unprecedented in modern history. We are now living through the third great power shift of the modern era. It could be called the rise of the rest. Over the past few decades, countries all over the world have been experiencing rates of economic growth that were once unthinkable. While there have been booms and busts, the overall trend has been unambiguously upward. This growth has been most visible in Asia, but is no longer confined to it. That is why to call this shift the rise of Asia does not describe it accurately. In 2006 and 2007, 124 countries grew at a rate of 4% or more. That includes more than 30 countries in Africa, two-thirds of the continent. Antoine van Achtmeyl, the fund manager who coined the term emerging markets, has identified the 25 companies most likely to be the world's next great multinationals. His list includes four companies each from Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, and Taiwan, three from India, two from China, and one each from Argentina, Chile, Malaysia, and South Africa. Look around. The tallest building in the world is now in Taipei, and it will soon be overtaken by one being built in Dubai. The world's richest man is Mexican, and its largest publicly traded corporation is Chinese. The world's biggest plane is built in Russia and Ukraine. Its leading refinery is under construction in India, and its largest factories are all in China. By many measures, London is becoming the leading financial center, and the United Arab Emirates is home to the most richly endowed investment fund. Once quintessentially American icons have been appropriated by foreigners. The world's largest Ferris wheel is in Singapore. Its number one casino is not in Las Vegas, but in Macau, which has also overtaken Vegas in annual gambling revenues. The biggest movie industry, in terms of both movies made and tickets sold, is Bollywood, not Hollywood. Even shopping, America's greatest sporting activity, has gone global. Of the top 10 malls in the world, only one is in the United States. The world's biggest is in Beijing. Such lists are arbitrary, but it is striking that only 10 years ago, America was at the top of many, if not most, of these categories. It might seem strange to focus on growing prosperity when there are hundreds of millions of people living in desperate poverty. But in fact, the share of people living on a dollar a day or less plummeted from 40% in 1981 to 18% in 2004, and it is estimated to fall to 12% by 2015. China's growth alone has lifted more than 400 million people out of poverty. Poverty is falling in countries housing 80% of the world's population. The 50 countries where the Earth's poorest people live are basket cases that need urgent attention. In the other 142, which include China, India, Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, Turkey, Kenya, and South Africa, the poor are slowly being absorbed into productive and growing economies. For the first time ever, we are witnessing genuinely global growth. This is creating an international system in which countries in all parts of the world are no longer objects or observers, but players in their own right. It is the birth of a truly global order. A related aspect of this new era is the diffusion of power from states to other actors. The rest that is rising includes many non-state actors. Groups and individuals have been empowered. Hierarchy, centralization, and control are being undermined. Functions that were once controlled by governments are now shared with international bodies like the World Trade Organization and the European Union. Non-governmental groups are mushrooming every day on every issue in every country. Corporations and capital are moving from place to place, finding the best location in which to do business, rewarding some governments while punishing others. Terrorists like Al-Qaeda, drug cartels, insurgents, and militias of all kinds are finding space to operate within the nooks and crannies of the international system. Power is shifting away from nation-states, up, down, and sideways. In such an atmosphere, the traditional applications of national power, both economic and military, have become less effective. The emerging international system is likely to be quite different from those that have preceded it. 100 years ago, there was a multipolar order run by a collection of European governments, with constantly shifting alliances, rivalries, miscalculations, and wars. Then came the bipolar duopoly of the Cold War, more stable in many ways, but with the superpowers reacting and overreacting to each other's every move. Since 1991, we've lived under an American imperium, a unique unipolar world in which the open global economy has expanded and accelerated dramatically. This expansion is now driving the next change in the nature of the international order. At the political-military level, we remain in a single superpower world. But in every other dimension, industrial, financial, educational, social, cultural, the distribution of power is shifting, moving away from American dominance. That does not mean we are entering an anti-American world, but we are moving into a post-American world, one defined and directed from many places and by many people. What kinds of opportunities and challenges do these changes present? What do they portend for the United States and its dominant position? What will this new era look like in terms of war and peace, economics and business, ideas and culture? In short, what will it mean to live in a post-American world? Chapter 2. The Cup Runneth Over. Imagine that it is January 2000, and you ask a fortune teller to predict the course of the global economy over the next several years. Let's say that you give him some clues to help him gaze into his crystal ball. The United States will be hit by the worst terrorist attack in history, you explain, and will respond by launching 2 wars, one of which will go badly awry and keep Iraq, the country with the world's 3rd largest oil reserves, in chaos for years. Iran will gain strength in the Middle East and move to acquire a nuclear capability. North Korea will go further, becoming the world's 8th declared nuclear power. Russia will turn hostile and imperious in its dealings with its neighbors and the West. In Latin America, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela will launch the most spirited anti-Western campaign in a generation, winning many allies and fans. Israel and Hezbollah will fight a war in southern Lebanon, destabilizing Beirut's fragile government, drawing in Iran and Syria, and rattling the Israelis. Gaza will become a failed state, ruled by Hamas, and peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians will go nowhere. Given these events, you say to the sage, how will the global economy fare over the next 6 years? This is not really a hypothetical. We have the forecasts of experts from those years. They were all wrong. The correct prediction would have been that between 2000 and 2007, the world economy would grow at its fastest pace in nearly four decades. Income per person across the globe would rise at a faster rate, 3.2%, than in any other period in history. In the two decades since the end of the Cold War, we have lived through a paradox, one we experience every morning when reading the newspapers. The world's politics seems deeply troubled, with daily reports of bombings, terror plots, rogue states, and civil strife. And yet the global economy forges ahead, not without significant interruptions and crises, but still vigorously upward on the whole. Markets do panic, but over economic, not political news. The front page of the newspaper seems unconnected to the business section. I remember speaking to a senior member of the Israeli government a few days after the war with Hezbollah in July 2006. He was genuinely worried about his country's physical security. Hezbollah's rockets had reached farther into Israel than people had believed possible, and the Israeli military response had not inspired confidence. Then I asked him about the economy, his area of competence. That's puzzled all of us, he said. The stock market was higher on the last day of the war than on the first. The same with the shekel, Israel's currency. The government might have been spooked, but the market wasn't. Or consider the Iraq War, which has produced deep, lasting chaos in the country and over 2 million refugees crowded into its neighbors. That kind of political crisis seems certain to spill over. But to travel in the Middle East these past years is to be struck by how little Iraq's troubles have destabilized the region. Everywhere you go, people angrily denounce American foreign policy. But where is the actual evidence of regional instability? Most Middle Eastern countries, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, for example, are booming. Turkey, which shares a border with Iraq, has averaged better than 7% annual growth since the war began. Abu Dhabi and Dubai, 1 hour from Baghdad by plane, continue to build eye-catching iconic skyscrapers as if they were on another planet. The countries that have involved themselves in Iraq, Syria, and Iran, operate largely outside the global economy and thus have less to lose by making trouble. What explains this mismatch between a politics that spirals downward and an economy that stays robust? First, it's worth looking more carefully at this cascade of bad news. It seems that we're living in crazily violent times, but don't believe everything you see on television. Our anecdotal impression turns out to be wrong. War and organized violence have declined dramatically over the last two decades. Ted Robert Gurr and a team of scholars at the University of Maryland's Center for International Development and Conflict Management tracked the data carefully and came to the following conclusion. The general magnitude of global warfare has decreased by over 60% since the mid-1980s, falling by the end of 2004 to its lowest level since the late 1950s. Violence increased steadily throughout the Cold War, increasing sixfold between the 1950s and early 1990s, but the trend peaked just before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and the extent of warfare among and within states lessened by nearly half in the first decade after the Cold War. Harvard's polymath professor Steven Pinker argues that today we are probably living in the most peaceful time in our species' existence. One reason for the mismatch between reality and our sense of it might be that over these same decades, we have experienced a revolution in information technology that now brings us news from around the world instantly, vividly, and continuously. The immediacy of the images and the intensity of the 24-hour news cycle combine to produce constant hyperbole. Every weather disturbance is the storm of the century. Every bomb that explodes is breaking news. It is difficult to put all of this in context because the information revolution is so new. We didn't get daily footage of the roughly 2 million who died in the killing fields of Cambodia in the 1970s, or the million who perished in the sands of the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. We have not even seen much footage from the war in Congo in the 1990s, where millions died. But now, we see almost daily live broadcasts of the effects of IEDs or car bombs or rockets, tragic events to be sure, but often with death tolls under 10. The randomness of terrorist violence, the targeting of civilians, and the ease with which modern societies can be penetrated add to our disquiet. "That could have been me," people say after a terrorist attack. It feels like a very dangerous world, but it isn't. Your chances of dying as a consequence of organized violence of any kind are low and getting lower. The data reveal a broad trend away from wars among major countries, the kind of conflict that produces massive casualties. I don't believe that war has become obsolete or any such foolishness. Human nature remains what it is, and international politics what it is. History has witnessed periods of calm that have been followed by extraordinary bloodshed. And numbers are not the only measure of evil. The nature of the killings in the former Yugoslavia in the early 1990s, premeditated, religiously motivated, systematic, makes that war, which had 200,000 casualties, a moral obscenity that should register very high on any scale. Al-Qaeda's barbarism, cold-blooded beheadings, the deliberate targeting of innocents, is gruesome despite its relatively low numbers of casualties. Still, if we are to understand the times we are living in, we must first accurately describe them. And they are, for now, in historical context, unusually calm. The Islamic threat. Islamic terror, which makes the headlines daily, is a large and persistent problem, but one involving small numbers of fanatics. It feeds on the dysfunctions of the Muslim world, the sense, real and imagined, of humiliation at the hands of the West, and easy access to technologies of violence. And yet, does it rank as a threat on the order of Germany's drive for world domination in the first half of the 20th century? Or Soviet expansionism in the second half? Or Mao's efforts to foment war and revolution across the Third World in the 1950s and 60s? These were all challenges backed by the power and purpose of major countries, often with serious allies, and with an ideology that was seen as a plausible alternative to liberal democracy. By comparison, consider the jihadist threat. Before 9/11, when groups like Al-Qaeda operated under the radar, governments treated them as minor annoyances, and they roamed freely, building some strength, and hit symbolic, often military targets, killing Americans and other foreigners. Even so, the damage was fairly limited. Since 2001, governments everywhere have been aggressive in busting terrorist networks, following their money, and tracking their recruits, with almost immediate results. In Indonesia, the largest Muslim nation in the world, the government captured both the chief and the military leader of Jamaah Islamiyah, the country's deadliest jihadist group, and the one that carried out the Bali bombings in 2002. With American help, the Filipino army battered Al-Qaeda-style terrorist outfit Abu Sayyaf. The group's leader was killed by Filipino troops in January 2007, and its membership has declined from as many as 2,000 guerrillas 6 years ago to a few hundred today. In Egypt and Saudi Arabia, Al-Qaeda's original bases and targets of attack, terrorist cells have been rounded up and those still at large have been unable to launch any new attacks in 3 years. Finance ministries, especially the U.S. Department of the Treasury, have made life far more difficult for terrorists. Global organizations cannot thrive without being able to move money around. And so the more terrorist funds are tracked and targeted, the more they have to resort to small-scale and hastily improvised operations. This struggle between governments and terrorists will persist, but it is the former who have the upper hand. In Iraq, where terrorist attacks have declined, a complication that is revealing has weakened al-Qaeda. In its original fatwas and other statements, al-Qaeda made no mention of Shiites, condemning only the Crusaders and Jews. But Iraq changed things. Searching for ways to attract Sunni support, al-Qaeda morphed into an anti-Shiite group espousing a purist Sunni worldview. The late Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the head of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, bore a fierce hatred for Shiites derived from his Wahhabi-style puritanism. In a February 2004 letter to Osama bin Laden, he claimed, "The danger from the Shia is greater than the Americans. The only solution is for us to strike the religious, military, and other cadres among the Shia with blow after blow until they bend to the Sunnis." If there was ever a debate between him and bin Laden, Zarqawi won. As a result, a movement that had hoped to rally the entire Muslim world to jihad against the West was dragged into a dirty internal war within Islam. The split between Sunnis and Shiites is only one of the divisions within the Islamic world. Within that universe are Shiites and Sunnis, Persians and Arabs, Southeast Asians and Middle Easterners, and importantly, moderates and radicals. Just as the diversity within the communist world ultimately made it less threatening, so do the many varieties of Islam undermine its ability to coalesce into a single monolithic foe. Some Western leaders speak of a single worldwide Islamic movement, absurdly lumping together Chechen separatists in Russia, Pakistani-backed militants in India, Shiite warlords in Lebanon, and Sunni jihadists in Egypt. In fact, a shrewd strategist would emphasize that all these groups are distinct, with differing agendas, enemies, and friends. That would rob them of their claim to represent Islam. It would also describe them as they often really are: small local gangs of misfits hoping to attract attention through nihilism and barbarism. Conflicts involving radical Islamic groups persist, but these typically have more to do with specific local conditions than with global aspirations. Although North Africa has seen continued terror, particularly in Algeria, the main group there, the Salafist Group for Call and Combat, known by its French abbreviation GSPC, is part of a long war between the Algerian government and Islamic opposition forces and cannot be seen solely through the prism of al-Qaeda or anti-American jihad. The same is true of the main area where there has been a large and extremely dangerous increase in the strength of al-Qaeda, the Afghanistan-Pakistan borderlands. It is here that al-Qaeda Central is housed. But the group has been able to sustain itself despite the best efforts of NATO troops because it had dug deep roots in the area during the years of the anti-Soviet campaign. Its allies, the Taliban, are a local movement that has long been supported by a section of the Pashtuns, an influential ethnic group in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Here is the bottom line. In the 6 years since 9/11, Al-Qaeda Central, the group led by Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri, has been unable to launch a major attack anywhere. It was a terrorist organization. It has become a communications company, producing the occasional videotape rather than actual terrorism. Even if an attack were to take place tomorrow, the fact that for 6 years, al-Qaeda has been unable to organize one explosion anywhere is surely worth noting. Jihad continues, but the jihadists have had to scatter, making do with smaller targets, and operate on a local level, usually through groups with almost no connection to al-Qaeda Central. And this improvised strategy has a crippling weakness. It kills locals, thus alienating ordinary Muslims, a process that is well underway in countries as diverse as Indonesia, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Over the last 6 years, support for bin Laden and his goals has fallen steadily throughout the Muslim world. Between 2002 and 2007, approval of suicide bombing as a tactic, a figure that was always low, has dropped by over 50% in most Muslim countries that have been tracked. There have been more denunciations of violence and fatwas against bin Laden than ever before, including from prominent clerics in Saudi Arabia. Much more must happen to modernize the Muslim world, but the modernizers are no longer so scared. They have finally realized that for all the rhetoric of the madrasas and mosques, few people want to live under the writ of Al-Qaeda. Those who have, whether in Afghanistan or Iraq, have become its most dedicated opponents. In contrast to Soviet socialism or even fascism in the 1930s, no society looks with admiration and envy on the fundamentalist Islamic model. On an ideological level, it presents no competition to the Western-originated model of modernity that countries across the world are embracing. A cottage industry of scaremongering has flourished in the West, especially in the United States, since 9/11. Experts extrapolate every trend they don't like, foregoing any serious study of the data. Many conservative commentators have written about the impending Islamization of Europe. Eurabia, they call it, to make you even more uncomfortable. Except that the best estimates from U.S. intelligence agencies indicate that Muslims constitute about 3% of Europe's population and will rise to between 5 and 8% by 2025, after which they will probably plateau. The watchdogs note the musings of every crackpot imam, search the archives for each reference to the end of days, and record and distribute the late-night TV musings of every nutcase who glorifies martyrdom. They erupt in fury when a Somali taxi driver somewhere refuses to load a case of liquor into his car, seeing it as the beginning of Sharia in the West. But these episodes do not reflect the basic direction of the Muslim world. That world is also modernizing, though more slowly than the rest, and there are those who are trying to become leaders in rebellion against it. The reactionaries in the world of Islam are more numerous and extreme than those in other cultures. That world does have its dysfunctions, but they remain a tiny minority of the world's billion-plus Muslims. And neglecting the complicated context in which some of these pseudo-religious statements are made, such as an internal Iranian power struggle among clerics and non-clerics, leads to hair-raising but absurd predictions, like Bernard Lewis's confident claim that Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, planned to mark an auspicious date on the Islamic calendar, August 22, 2006, by ending the world. Yes, he actually wrote that. The ideological watchdogs have spent so much time with the documents of jihad that they have lost sight of actual Muslim societies. Were they to step back, they would see a frustration with the fundamentalists, a desire for modernity, with some dignity and cultural pride for sure, and a search for practical solutions, not a mass quest for immortality through death. When Muslims travel, they flock by the millions to see the razzle-dazzle of Dubai, not the seminaries of Iran. The minority that wants jihad is real, but it operates within societies where such activities are increasingly unpopular and irrelevant. In the West, the effects of terrorism have diminished with each additional attack. After September 11th, global financial markets collapsed and did not return to September 10th levels for 2 months. After the Madrid bombings in 2004, the Spanish market took a month to recover. After the London bombings in July 2005, British stocks were back to pre-bombing levels in 24 hours. The broader economic picture is similar. After 9/11, the United States lost hundreds of billions of dollars in economic activity. The next large attack, the Bali nightclub bombing in 2002, had a similarly dramatic effect on the Indonesian economy, with tourism vanishing and trade investment drying up for months. A year later, after another Indonesian bombing, this time at the Marriott Hotel in Jakarta, the market dropped only briefly, and the Indonesian economy suffered little damage. Bombings in Morocco and Turkey in 2003 had similarly small effects. The 2004 bombings in Spain and 2005 bombings in Britain did nothing to undermine growth. Of course, things would be different if a major terrorist organization were to acquire significant weapons of mass destruction. A nuclear attack could result in mass panic and a broader breakdown. But such weapons are harder to get than many think, and a more sustained effort from Washington could make it nearly impossible to acquire them in any quantity. Biological terror may seem most worrying because of the ease of acquiring biological agents, but dispersing them effectively is difficult and may lack the dramatic results terrorists crave. And none of this is to suggest that anti-terror activities are unnecessary, but rather that careful, calibrated, intelligent policies are likely to be quite successful. In some unspoken way, people have recognized that the best counterterrorism policy is resilience. Terrorism is unusual in that it is a military tactic defined by the response of the onlooker. If we are not terrorized, then it doesn't work. And from New York and London to Mumbai and Jakarta, people are learning this fact through experience and getting on with life, even amidst the uncertainty. The most likely scenario, a series of backpack or truck bombings in the United States, would be a shock. But in a couple of weeks, its effects would fade and the long-term consequences would likely be minimal. In vast, vigorous, and complex societies, the American economy is now $13 trillion. Problems in a few places do not easily spill over. Modern civilization may be stronger than we suspect. The challenges from rogue states are also real, but we should consider them in context. The GDP of Iran is 1/68 that of the United States. Its military spending is 1/110 that of the Pentagon. If this is 1938, as many conservatives argue, then Iran is Romania, not Germany. North Korea is even more bankrupt and dysfunctional. Its chief threat, the one that keeps the Chinese government awake at night, is that it will implode, flooding the region with refugees. That's power. These countries can cause trouble in their neighborhood and must be checked and contained, but we need to keep in mind the larger world of which they are a relatively small part. Look at Latin America. Venezuela is a troublemaker. But what has that meant on the ground? The broad trend in the region, exemplified by the policies of the major countries like Brazil, Mexico, and Chile, has been towards open markets, trade, democratic governance, and an outward orientation. And that trend, not Hugo Chavez's insane rants, represents the direction of history. The Great Expansion. Today's relative calm has a deep structural basis. Across the world, economics is trumping politics. What Wall Street analysts call political risk has been almost non-existent. Wars, coups, and terrorism have lost much of their ability to derail markets more than temporarily. Again, this may not last. It has not historically. But it is the world we have lived in for at least a decade. This is not the first time that political tumult and economic growth have come together. Two earlier periods seem much like ours: the turn-of-the-century boom of the 1890s and 1900s, and the post-war boom of the 1950s and early 1960s. In both, politics was turbulent, and yet growth was robust. These two periods had one feature in common: large countries were entering the world economy, increasing its size and changing its shape. The expansion of the pie was so big that it overwhelmed day-to-day dislocations. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, fears of war between European great powers were frequent, often triggered by crises in the Balkans, North Africa, and other hotspots. But the world economy boomed, despite flashpoints and arms races. This was the era of the first great movements of capital from Europe to the New World. As Germany and the United States industrialized quickly, they became two of the three largest economies in the world. The 1950s and early 1960s are sometimes remembered as placid, but they were in fact tension-filled times, defined by the early years of the Cold War, fears of conflict with the Soviet Union and China, a real war in Korea. There were periodic crises: the Taiwan Straits, the Congo, the Suez Canal, the Bay of Pigs, Vietnam, that often mushroomed into war. And yet, the industrial economies sailed along strongly. This was the second great age of capital movement, with money from the United States pouring into Europe and East Asia. As a consequence, Western Europe rebuilt itself from the ashes of World War II, and Japan, the first non-Western nation to successfully industrialize, grew over 9% a year for 23 years. In both periods, these positive supply shocks, an economist's term for a long-run spike in production, caused long, sustained booms, with falling prices, low interest rates, and rising productivity in the emerging markets of the day, Germany, the United States, Japan. At the turn of the 20th century, despite robust growth in demand, wheat prices declined by 20 to 35% in Europe, thanks to American granaries. Similarly, the price of manufactured goods is falling today because of lowered costs in Asia, even as demand for them soars. In both periods, the new players grew through exports, but imports expanded as well. Between 1860 and 1914, America's imports increased fivefold, while its exports increased sevenfold. We are living through the third such expansion of the global economy, and by far the largest. Over the last two decades, about 2 billion people have entered the world of markets and trade, a world that was until recently the province of a small club of Western countries. I say 2 billion because the rural poor in South Asia, China, and Africa are not in any significant sense participating in the global economy, but millions of them move to the cities every year. The expansion was spurred by the movement of Western capital to Asia and across the globe. As a result, between 1990 and 2007, the global economy grew from 22.8 trillion to 53.3 trillion, and global trade increased 133%. The so-called emerging markets have accounted for over half of this global growth, and they now account for over 40% of the world economy, measured at purchasing power parity, or over 30% at market exchange rates. Increasingly, the growth of newcomers is being powered by their own markets, not simply by exports to the West, which means that this is not an ephemeral phenomenon. Some people dismiss such trends by pointing to the rise of Japan in the 1980s, when Westerners were scared that the Japanese would come to dominate the world economy. That turned out to be a phantom fear. Japan, in fact, went into a 15-year slump. But the analogy is misleading. In 1985, Japan was already the second largest economy in the world. Many experts believed it was on track to unseat the United States as the largest. But because Japan's economy, institutions, and politics were still not fully modernized, the country could not make that final leap. China, by contrast, is still a poor country. It has a per capita GDP of $2,500. It will certainly face many problems as and when it becomes a first world country. But for the foreseeable future, it will surely manage to double the size of its economy just by continuing to make toys and shirts and cell phones. India, starting at an even lower base income, will also be able to grow for several decades before hitting the kinds of challenges that derail Japan. Even if India and China never get past middle income status, they are likely to be the second and third largest economies in the world for much of the 21st century. It is an accident of history that for the last several centuries, the richest countries in the world have all happened to have small populations. The United States was the biggest of the bunch by far, which is why it has been the dominant player. But such dominance was possible only in a world in which the truly large countries were mired in poverty, unable or unwilling to adopt policies that made them grow. Now the giants are on the move, and naturally, given their size, they will have a large footprint on the map. Even if the average person in these countries still seems poor by Western standards, their total wealth will be massive. Or, to put it in mathematical terms, any number, however small, becomes a large number when multiplied by 2.5 billion, the approximate population of China plus India. It is these two factors, a low starting point and a large population, that guarantee the magnitude and long-term nature of the global power shift. The three forces: politics, economics, and technology. How did all this come to be? To answer that question, we have to go back a few decades, to the 1970s, and recall the way most countries ran their economies at the time. I remember the atmosphere vividly because I was growing up in India, a country that really didn't think it was playing on the same field as the United States. In the minds of India's policy and intellectual elites, there was a US-led capitalist model on one end of the spectrum and a Soviet-led socialist model on the other. New Delhi was trying to carve a middle way between them. In this respect, India was not unusual. Brazil, Egypt, and Indonesia, and in fact a majority of the world, were on this middle path. But it turned out to be a road to nowhere. And this was becoming apparent to many people in these countries by the late 1970s. As they stagnated, Japan and a few other East Asian economies that had charted a quasi-capitalist course succeeded conspicuously, and the lesson started to sink in. But the earthquake that shook everything was the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s. With central planning totally discredited and one end of the political spectrum in ruins, the entire debate shifted. Suddenly, there was only one basic approach to organizing a country's economy. This is why Alan Greenspan has described the fall of the Soviet Union as the seminal economic event of our times. Since then, despite all the unease about various liberalization and marketization plans, the general direction has not changed. As Margaret Thatcher famously put it in the years when she was reviving the British economy, there is no alternative. The ideological shift in economics had been building over the 1970s and 1980s, even before the fall of the Berlin Wall. Conventional economic wisdom, embodied in organizations such as the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, had become far more critical of the quasi-socialist path of countries like India. Academic experts like Jeffrey Sachs traveled around the world advising governments to liberalize, liberalize, liberalize. Graduates of Western economics programs, such as Chile's Chicago Boys, went home and implemented market-friendly policies. Some developing countries worried about becoming rapacious capitalists, and Sachs recalls explaining to them that they should debate long and hard whether they wanted to end up more like Sweden, France, or the United States. But, he would add, they didn't have to worry about that decision for a while. Most of them were still much closer to the Soviet Union. The financial force that has powered the new era is the free movement of capital. This, too, is a relatively recent phenomenon. The post-World War II period was one of fixed exchange rates. Most Western countries, including France and Italy, had capital controls restricting the movement of currency in and out of their borders. The dollar was pegged to gold. But as global trade grew, fixed rates created frictions and inefficiencies and prevented capital from being put to its best use. Most Western countries removed controls during the 1970s and 1980s. The result? A vast and ever-growing supply of capital that could move freely from one place to the next. Today, when people think about globalization, they still think of it mostly in terms of the huge amount of cash. Currency traders swap about $2 trillion a day that sloshes around the globe, rewarding some countries and punishing others. It is globalization's celestial mechanism for discipline. Along with freely floating money came another policy revolution, the spread of independent central banks and the taming of inflation. Hyperinflation is the worst economic malady that can befall a nation. It wipes out the value of money, savings, assets, and thus work. It is worse even than a deep recession. Hyperinflation robs you of what you have now, savings, whereas a recession robs you of what you might have had, higher standards of living, if the economy had grown. That's why hyperinflation has so often toppled governments and produced revolution. It was not the Great Depression that brought the Nazis to power in Germany, but rather hyperinflation, which destroyed the middle class by making its savings worthless. It is rare that one can look back at a war that was so decisively won. In the late 1980s, dozens of large, important countries were beset by hyperinflation. In Argentina, it was at 3,500%. in Brazil, 1,200%, and in Peru, 2,500%. In the 1990s, one after the other of these developing countries moved soberly towards monetary and fiscal discipline. Some accepted the need to float their currencies, others linked their currencies to the euro or the dollar. As a result, there are today only 12 countries worldwide where inflation is over 15%, and most of them are failed states like Haiti, Burma, and Zimbabwe. This broad atmosphere of low inflation has been crucial to the political stability and good economic fortunes of the emerging nations. Along with these political and economic factors moving countries towards a new consensus came a series of technological innovations that pushed in the same direction. It is difficult today to remember life back in the dark days of the 1970s when news was not conveyed instantly. But by the 1990s, events happening anywhere, East Berlin, Kuwait, Tiananmen Square, were transmitted in real time everywhere. We tend to think of news mainly as political, but prices are also a kind of news, and the ability to convey prices instantly and transparently across the globe has triggered another revolution of efficiency. Today it is routine to compare prices for products in a few minutes on the internet. 20 years ago, there was a huge business in arbitrage because such instant price comparison was so difficult. The expansion of communications meant that the world got more deeply connected and became flat, in Thomas Friedman's famous formulation. Cheap phone calls and broadband made it possible for people to do jobs for one country in another country, marking the next stage in the ongoing story of capitalism. With the arrival of big ships in the 15th century, goods became mobile. With modern banking in the 17th century, capital became mobile. In the 1990s, labor became mobile. People could not necessarily go to where the jobs were, but jobs could go to where the people were. And they went to programmers in India, telephone operators in the Philippines, and radiologists in Thailand. The cost of transporting goods and services has been falling for centuries. With the advent of broadband, it has dropped to zero for many services. Not all jobs can be outsourced, not by a long shot, but the effect of outsourcing can be felt everywhere. In a sense, this is how trade has always worked. Textile factories shifted from Great Britain to Japan in the early 20th century, for example. But instant and constant communications means that this process has accelerated sharply. A clothing factory in Thailand can be managed almost as if it were in the United States. Companies now use dozens of countries as parts of a chain that buys, manufactures, assembles, markets, and sells goods. Since the 1980s, these three forces, politics, economics, and technology, have pushed in the same direction to produce a more open, connected, exacting international environment. But they have also given countries everywhere fresh opportunities to start moving up the ladder of growth and prosperity. Consider the sea change in two representative non-Asian countries. 20 years ago, Brazil and Turkey would have been considered typical developing countries, with sluggish growth, rampant inflation, spiraling debt, an anemic private sector, and a fragile political system. Today, both are well-managed and boast historically low inflation, vigorous growth rates, falling debt levels, a thriving private sector, and increasingly stable democratic institutions. Brazil's inflation rate is now, for the first time in history, roughly the same as that of the United States. Brazil and Turkey still have problems, what country doesn't? But they are serious nations on the rise. Markets have already shifted their perceptions of these countries. Their debt is no longer regarded as any more risky than first world debt. In fact, many emerging countries are piling up large surpluses, so much so that they now hold 75% of the world's foreign exchange reserves. China alone has over $1.5 trillion in its accounts. Goldman Sachs has predicted that by 2040, five emerging market countries, China, India, Brazil, Russia, and Mexico, will together have a larger economic output than the G7 countries, the seven Western nations that have dominated global affairs for centuries. The Problems of Plenty. For the last 2 decades, we have spent much time, energy, and attention worrying about crises and breakdown in the global economy and terrorism, nuclear blackmail, and war in geopolitics. This is natural. Preparing for the worst can help avert it. And we have indeed had bad news, from wars in the Balkans and Africa, to terrorism around the world, to economic crises in East Asia, Russia, and most dangerously now, the United States. But focusing on the gloom has also left us unprepared for many of the largest problems we face, which are the product not of failure, but success. The fact that we are living in a world of synchronous global growth is good news, for the most part, but it is also raising a series of complex and potentially lethal dilemmas. Global growth is the big story of our times. It explains the rise of liquidity, the ever-growing piles of money moving around the world that has kept credit cheap and assets, including real estate, stocks, and bonds, expensive. At the same time, the boom in low-wage countries has prevented inflation from rising too much. One way to think about India and China is as two great global deflation machines, pumping out goods, in the case of China, and services, in the case of India, for a fraction of what they would cost to produce in the West. This is one of the chief reasons that central banks haven't had to worry much about inflation and have been able to maintain low interest rates for almost 2 decades, an unusually long stretch of time. Of course, low interest rates and cheap credit also cause people to act foolishly or greedily, inflating bubbles in technology stocks, housing, subprime mortgages, or emerging market equities, bubbles that eventually pop. As the world gets more interconnected and financial instruments more exotic, many observers worry that this virtuous cycle of growth and confidence could turn into a vicious one of panic and depression. But so far, even as the unwinding of crises is extremely painful, the diverse new sources of growth and massive quantities of new capital have given the global economic system as a whole greater resilience. Consider rising oil prices. The oil shock of the noughts, how else to describe the decade 2000 to 2010, has been different from previous ones. In the past, prices rose because oil producers, OPEC, artificially restricted supply and thus forced up the cost of gasoline. In recent years, by contrast, prices have risen because of demand from China, India, and other emerging markets, as well as the continuing massive demand in the developed world. If prices are rising because economies are growing, it means that economies have the vigor and flexibility to handle increased costs by improving productivity and, to a lesser extent, by passing them on to consumers. As a result, the price hikes of the noughts have been more easily digested. Had we asked our fortune teller in 2000 to assess the effects of a quadrupling in oil prices, he would have surely predicted a massive global recession. It's not just oil that has become more expensive. Commodity prices are at a 200-year high. Raw materials of all kinds are increasingly dear. Agricultural produce is now so expensive that developing countries face a growing political problem of how to respond to food inflation. The cost of construction has exploded from New York to Dubai to Shanghai. Even the humble gas helium, which is used not merely in party balloons, but also in MRI machines and microchip factories, is in short supply globally, and is the second most abundant element in the universe. These pressures will surely at some point end the era of low inflation that has undergirded global prosperity. Meanwhile, robust growth has also produced a number of anomalies. Within an increasingly globalized and disciplined world, certain countries, those endowed with natural resources, especially petroleum and natural gas, are getting free rides. They are surfing the wave of global growth, getting rich without having to play by most of the rules that govern the global economy. This phenomenon is the strange but inevitable outgrowth of the success of everyone else. These countries are the non-market parasites on a market world. Consider the principal political challenges to the United States and to Western ideas of international order. In the Middle East, they come from Iran. in Latin America from Venezuela, and in Eurasia from Russia. All have newfound strength built on oil. Sudan's ability to defy the world over Darfur is difficult to imagine absent its oil reserves. Petroleum brings in eye-popping amounts of cash today. Iran's take from oil in 2006 amounted to $50 billion, enough to dispense patronage to interest groups, bribe the army, and stay in power, while still having piles left over to foment trouble abroad. This situation is unlikely to change. Resource-rich countries will thrive as long as the others are growing. It's the yin and yang of today's globalization. Not all resource-rich countries are rogues, and the climate of good economic management has led some to use their riches more wisely than before. Canada is becoming a major power and yet acting extremely responsibly. The Persian Gulf, where so much of the oil revenue flows, is investing more of its profits in infrastructure and industry rather than in Swiss bank accounts and Monte Carlo casinos, though there is certainly much of that as well. Dubai has become an efficiently run, business-friendly entrepot, a Middle Eastern Singapore. Other Gulf states are now trying to emulate its success. Saudi Arabia, which for decades has mismanaged its vast fortune, plans to invest $70 billion in new petrochemical projects, aiming to become a leading petrochemical producer by 2015. The Gulf states have made $1 trillion in capital investments over the last 5 years, and McKinsey and Company estimate that they could invest another $2 trillion over the next decade. This is a state-directed form of capitalism, which is likely to result in narrow development and unlikely to produce self-sustaining growth, although there are strong state-directed elements in European and East Asian capitalism as well. But it is much closer to the global capitalist norm than the economic systems of these countries, from Russia to Saudi Arabia, a generation ago. The most acute problem of plenty is the impact of global growth on natural resources and the environment. It is not an exaggeration to say that the world is running out of clean air, potable water, agricultural produce, and many vital commodities. Some of these problems can be fixed by improving efficiency and developing new sources of supply, but progress has been far too slow. Agricultural productivity, for example, is rising, but feeding a global population of 8 billion, which we will get to by 2025, will require crop yields to reach 4 tons per hectare from only 3 tons today. Similarly, our ability to manage and conserve water is not growing nearly as fast as our consumption of it. World population tripled in the 20th century, but water consumption increased sixfold. Americans use more than 400 liters of water a day to drink, cook, and clean themselves. People in poorer countries are lucky to get 40. But as they get richer, their rising demands will cause greater stress. Violent clashes over water have already broken out in Africa and the Middle East. Historically, populations have moved to find water. If water sources dry up in the future, tens of millions of people will be forced to start moving. Over the last decade, many predictions about the effects of climate change have proven to be underestimates because global growth has exceeded all projections. The most recent assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was released in mid-2007. By the year's end, scientists had shown that the polar ice caps are melting twice as fast as the report expected. There is greater demand for electricity, more cars and more planes than anyone imagined 15 years ago. And it keeps growing. The McKinsey Global Institute projects that from 2003 to 2020, the number of vehicles in China will rise from 26 million to 120 million. And then there's India, Russia, the Middle East, the rest. Demand for electricity is projected to rise over 4% a year for decades. And that electricity will mostly come from the dirtiest fuel available, coal. Coal is cheap and plentiful, so the world relies on it to produce most of its electricity. To understand the impact on global warming, consider this fact. Between 2006 and 2012, China and India will build 800 new coal-fired power plants, with combined CO2 emissions that are 5 times the total savings of the Kyoto Accords. The rise of nationalism. In a globalized world, almost all problems spill over borders. Whether it's terrorism, nuclear proliferation, disease, environmental degradation, economic crisis, or water scarcity, no issue can be addressed without significant coordination and cooperation among many countries. But while economics, information, and even culture might have become globalized, formal political power remains firmly tethered to the nation-state, even as the nation-state has become less able to solve most of these problems unilaterally. And increasingly, nation-states are becoming less willing to come together to solve common problems. As the number of players, governmental and non-governmental, increases, and each one's power and confidence grows, the prospects for agreement and common action diminish. This is the central challenge of the rise of the rest: to stop the forces of global growth from turning into the forces of global disorder and disintegration. The rise of pride and confidence among other nations, particularly the largest and most successful ones, is readily apparent. For me, it was vividly illustrated a few years ago in an internet cafe in Shanghai, where I was chatting with a young Chinese executive. He was describing the extraordinary growth that was taking place in his country, and a future in which China would be both modern and prosperous. He was thoroughly westernized in dress and demeanor, spoke excellent English, and could comfortably discuss the latest business trends or gossip about American pop culture. He seemed the consummate product of globalization, the person who bridges cultures and makes the world a smaller, more cosmopolitan place. But when we began talking about Taiwan, Japan, and the United States, his responses were filled with bile. He explained in furious tones that were Taiwan to dare to declare independence, China should instantly invade it. He said that Japan was an aggressor nation that could never be trusted. He was sure that the United States deliberately bombed the Chinese embassy during the Kosovo War in 1999 to terrify the Chinese people with its military might, and so on. I felt as if I were in Berlin in 1910, speaking to a young German professional, who in those days would also have been both thoroughly modern and thoroughly nationalist. As economic fortunes rise, so does nationalism. This is understandable. Imagine that you lived in a country that had been poor and unstable for centuries. And then finally, things turn, and your nation is on the rise. You would be proud and anxious to be seen. This desire for recognition and respect is surging throughout the world. It may seem paradoxical that globalization and economic modernization are breeding political nationalism, but that is only if we view nationalism as a backward ideology, certain to be erased by the onward march of progress. Nationalism has always perplexed Americans. When the United States involves itself abroad, it always believes that it is genuinely trying to help other countries better themselves. From the Philippines and Haiti to Vietnam and Iraq, the natives' reaction to U.S. efforts has taken Americans by surprise. Americans take justified pride in their own country, we call it patriotism, and yet are genuinely startled when other people are proud and possessive of theirs. In the waning days of Britain's rule in India, its last viceroy, Lord Louis Mountbatten, turned to the great Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi and said in exasperation, "If we just leave, there will be chaos." Gandhi replied, "Yes, but it will be our chaos." That sense of being governed by one's own, without interference, is a powerful feeling in emerging countries, especially those that were once colonies or quasi-colonies of the West. Zbigniew Brzezinski recently called attention to what he terms a global political awakening. He pointed to rising mass passions fueled by various forces: economic success, national pride, higher levels of education, greater information and transparency, and memories of the past. Brzezinski noted the disruptive aspects of this new force, the population of much of the developing world is politically stirring and in many places seethes with unrest, he wrote. It is acutely conscious of social injustice to an unprecedented degree, and this is creating a community of shared perceptions and envy that can be galvanized and channeled by demagogic political or religious passions. These energies transcend sovereign borders and pose a challenge both to existing states as well as to the existing global hierarchy, on top of which America still perches. In many countries outside the Western world, there is a pent-up frustration with having to accept an entirely Western or American narrative of world history, one in which they either are miscast or remain bit players. Russians have long chafed at the standard narrative about World War II, in which Britain and the United States heroically defeat the forces of fascist Germany and Japan. Given mainstream U.S. historical accounts, from Stephen Ambrose to Ken Burns, Americans could be forgiven for believing that Russia played a minor part in the decisive battles against Hitler and Tojo. In fact, the Eastern Front was the central arena of World War II. It involved more land combat than all other theaters of the war put together and resulted in 30 million deaths. It was where three-quarters of all German forces fought and where Germany incurred 70% of its casualties. The European front was in many ways a sideshow, but in the West it is treated as the main event. As the writer Benjamin Schwartz has pointed out, Stephen Ambrose lavishes attention on the U.S.-British invasion of Sicily, which drove 60,000 Germans from the island, but completely ignores Kursk, the largest battle in history, in which at least 1.5 million Soviets and Germans fought, and which occurred at exactly the same time. Much as it may make us squirm, we must admit that the struggle against Nazi Germany was primarily, as the great military historian John Erickson called it, Stalin's war. Or consider the perspective on the same war from another spot on the map. An Indian friend explained to me, "For Britain and America, World War II is a heroic struggle in which freedom triumphs over evil. For us, it was a battle to which Britain committed India and its armed forces without bothering to consult us. London told us to die for an idea of freedom that it was at that very moment brutally denying to us." Such divergent national perspectives have always existed, but today, thanks to greater education, information, and confidence, they are widely disseminated on new news networks, cable channels, and internet sites in the emerging world. Many of the rest are dissecting the narratives, arguments, and assumptions of the West and countering them with a different view of the world. When you tell us that we support a dictatorship in Sudan to have access to oil, a young Chinese official told me in 2006, what I want to say is, and how is that different from your support for a medieval monarchy in Saudi Arabia? We see the hypocrisy. We just don't say anything yet. After the Cold War ended, there was a general hope and expectation that China and Russia would move inexorably into the post-World War II Western political and economic system. When George H.W. Bush spoke of a new world order, he meant simply that the old Western one would be extended worldwide. Perhaps this view stemmed from the post-war experience with Japan and Germany, both of which rose to the heights of economic power and yet were accommodating, cooperative, and largely silent members of the existing order. But perhaps those were special circumstances. The two countries had unique histories, having waged aggressive wars and become pariahs as a consequence, and they faced a new threat from Soviet communism and relied on American military power for their protection. The next round of rising powers might not be so eager to fit in. We still think of a world in which a rising power must choose between two stark options: integrate into the Western order or reject it, becoming a rogue nation and facing the penalties of excommunication. In fact, rising powers appear to be following a third way: entering the Western order, but doing so on their own terms, thus reshaping the system itself. As the political scientists Nazin Barma, Eli Ratner, and Stephen Weber point out, in a world where everyone feels empowered, countries can choose to bypass this Western center entirely and forge their own ties with one another. In a post-American world, there may be no center to integrate into. The U.S. Secretary of State James Baker suggested in 1991 that the world was moving toward a hub-and-spoke system, with every country going through the United States to get to its destination. The 21st century world might be better described as one of point-to-point routes, with new flight patterns being mapped every day. This is true even in a physical sense. In just 10 years, the number of Russian visitors to China increased more than fourfold, from 489,000 in 1995 to 2.2 million in 2005. The focus has shifted. Countries are increasingly interested in themselves, the story of their rise, and pay less attention to the West and the United States. As a result, the urgent discussions on the presidential campaign trail throughout 2007 about the need to lessen anti-Americanism are somewhat off point. The world is moving from anger to indifference, from anti-Americanism to post-Americanism. The fact that new powers are more strongly asserting their interests is the reality of the post-American world. It also raises the political conundrum of how to achieve international objectives in a world of many actors, state and non-state. According to the old model of getting things done, the United States and a few Western allies directed the show, while the Third World either played along or stayed outside the box and remained irrelevant as a result. Non-governmental players were too few and too weak to worry about. Now look at something like trade negotiations, and you see the developing world acting with greater and greater force. Where they might once have taken any deal offered by the West or ignored the process altogether, countries like Brazil and India play hardball until they get the deal of their choice. They have heard Western CEOs explain where the future lies. They have read the Goldman Sachs BRIC report. They know that the balance of power has shifted.